The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Lee Pringle is the founder and artistic director of the Color of Music Festival. He's an accomplished tenor who's founded and led numerous choral ensembles, and he's a musical visionary and entrepreneur who has formed a marketing and production firm that has co-produced and assisted in forming the Charleston International Festival of Choirs and the African Choral Festival in Ghana, West Africa, among a long list of other projects. Lee Pringle joins me by Skype to talk about his passion for music, his personal journey and career, and his focus on bringing to light the contributions of Black classically trained musicians, African American spirituals, and so much more. Mr. Pringle, I am so pleased to speak with you.
Thank you. Likewise, I'm excited to be speaking with you as well.
Great. Now, your career accomplishments are so broad and so numerous, I hardly knew where to begin, actually. And I want to get to the Color of Music Festival as well as to your many other projects. But I want to talk about how you cultivated your passion for music and how you got to this point in your career. And I would love for you to dial it back and talk about your experience in music as a child, your formative years as a musician.
Well, thank you so much for having an interest in the Color of Music and, you know, what was my journey to this place and time. You know, like many in the African American community, and I say many because, you know, I don't want to speak monolithically because not all Black folks have had the same experience, but there's one common thing that we have is we were all brought here through ancestors who came before us. And a lot of the traditions that came from various parts of West Africa are a part of our DNA and how we process and do things here on North America's continent. So I was raised in an AME church. My great-grandfather started Mount Pisgah AME Church in a little small unincorporated town called Pringletown. And I had the experiences of listening to older people singing the African-American spiritual sacred music, literally with very little instrumentation, but on pitch. And that really was the basis and the foundation of many of the things that I have done to this day, taking that, what I call cadence of the continent of Africa in a little small rural church, and being able to go many, many places around the globe to experience music and be part of music. So that's how the origin started.
Wow. So how did you personally cultivate your education? And are you an instrumentalist at all? Do you play any instruments?
I played percussion in school, but I had a very inspirational music educator by the name of Mildred Gilmore Brevard. She was a very accomplished songstress. And when you're in elementary school, you have no idea that your teachers have a life outside of the classroom and they have you for 30 or 40 minutes. You just think they're Miss Brevard and that's it. But I learned after I became active with the Charleston Symphony, producing concerts for them, that she was on the Spoleto and Piccolo Spoleto bill. And when I did a little bit of research, I found out that she was a phenomenal jazz lyricist. And unfortunately, she died much too young. About a decade ago, but she inspired myself and many other young Black boys in a rural Title I school where literally everybody in the school, I would say less, maybe 1.5% wasn't on free lunch. But what we had was Black educators who came to school knowing that we needed to be prepared in any endeavor, you know, be it quantitative or the fine arts or arts. They pushed us and held us accountable on every subject. And music was one of those that resonated with me. And Mildred Brevard was the person who really gave me that fire for music.
You really had quite a well-rounded education. It also sounds more like a mentorship.
Yeah, a mentorship. And, you know, I became involved with classically trained artists early in my, I guess I would say my late teens, early 20s to mid 20s. And I actually did not start, you know, doing vocal training until, you know, much later, but learned that I had a natural lilt as a tenor and my range was pretty expansive. So those things kind of helped me to get into the, you know, starting choral groups and, you know, taking the choral groups from that experience I had with the Masterworks classics, you know, from all the requiems from Verdi to Brahms, Mozart, and dialing it back to really explore how we, meaning as Black people in North America, got its navigation in place for the music that, you know, Marian Anderson, Leann T. Price, and, you know, Shirley Ferrette, Jesse Norman, we can go on and on and on, Simon Estes, just to name, you know, some Black baritones, male vocalists out there. So, yeah, that's where it started to kind of meander.
So one of your career focuses is finding ways to enhance and expand the appreciation of the African-American spiritual and also Black classically trained musicians' contributions to the genre. I want to know, what should we know about spirituals that maybe we overlook or didn't understand?
The first thing is, of all the colonized areas around the globe, the African-American spiritual only got its origins on the continent of North America. Throughout the Southeast, I would say more prominently the Carolina colony, you know, Georgia, South Carolina, northern part of Florida. And that was as a result of, you know, over 200 years of being oppressed and basically giving up all the various religions that this amalgamation of people who came together who really weren't all one synchronized group as it relates to cultures. They had their own unique cultures, but found themselves on this land, you know, being, you know, imaginable predicaments, forced to listen to and absorb, you know, the Anglican way of worship. And the King James Version of the Bible became that place where, even though these folks had been oppressed, or my ancestors rather had been oppressed and enslaved for hundreds of years, they took from that the salvation of what the words actually said. And that formation of the oral tradition of singing to get through the day and imagining what those words actually meant would give them some type of salvation and, you know, over yonder, you know, formed the basis of something that there's no classical artist out there that's a vocalist in any respect that will not have a spiritual or spirituals on a recital or make it a point to include that in the canon of music that they sing wherever they go if they have an opportunity. So the spiritual was uniquely for us here in the United States, and it has permeated around the globe because it is the beginning of really the Black musical experience in North America. Every genre now that people connect to Black singers, most of it has its roots with the African-American spiritual. So around 1871 is when it was coined by the Fisk Jubilee Singers out of Nashville, Tennessee, and they are still going strong to this day in Nashville.
What are some of your favorite spirituals?
Oh, I have so many.
I'll bet.
I would say Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Uh-huh. And I just produced in Nashville under the baton of Dr. David Morrow, who's the director of choral activities at Morehouse College. We did an iteration of that. Robert Nathaniel Dett coined a beautiful 14-minute piece for chorus and organ called the Chariot Jubilee. And the melody of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot is the basis of a lot of what the chorus sings. It's a beautiful piece, not very well known. There's an orchestration of it. We've used that as well, but I would encourage your listeners to go to YouTube and find Robert Nathaniel Dett's Chariot Jubilee. It's a beautiful piece, and we need more choruses around America and the globe to perform that beautiful piece.
Could you talk a little bit about the African Choral Festival in Ghana? That is very intriguing.
The Choral Festival in Ghana was something that was truly a highlight of my choral contributions. You know, the government of Ghana has changed, and so the festival has become something a little different than what it was when I was originally involved with it. But a friend of mine out of Vermont by the name of Jody Breckenridge, we both partnered with the government of Ghana to form the first choral festival there in Accra. And it was an amazing experience. We partnered with Dr. Andre Thomas of Florida State University as the guest conductor of this course. And if you have never had the opportunity to listen to Ghanaian chorus singing, it is an earth-shattering, literally when I say earth-shattering. The root of the singing has such a depth from the bass section of the chorus. Dr. Thomas said the only basses that he'd ever heard singing with that kind of depth were Russian basses. It's just something about the anatomy of a certain region of the world. The sound resonates in a way. And I tell you that the Ghanaian choruses not only sing exquisitely beautiful, everyone in the bass section sounds like a basso profondo. It's so amazing to hear them sing, but the movement, their costumes are so beautifully coordinated with all those vibrant African colors. It is a sight to be seen. And that was something that was really a highlight of all the choral things that I've done, to be on the west coast of Africa in Ghana, singing and producing a performance on a stage like that. It was absolutely amazing.
And you have done a lot, that's saying a lot, because you formed so many choirs and have done so much repertoire and have staged so many concerts and projects. To say that that was a highlight is a very big deal.
Actually, you know, November 8th in Nashville, we performed, I guess you could say, a very unique program at Ingram Hall at Vanderbilt University. Chelsea Tipton of the Southeast Orchestra of Texas was the conductor. And we did this program that truly, how would I put it? If you know anything about American history, you know that the rice plantations in the Carolinas was the Intel Pentium processor of its day. Mm-hmm. And it made those rice barons, you know, the Bill Gates and the Oracle CEOs and Amazons of today, so wealthy. You know, the Charleston area was one of the wealthiest. And we did this honor to those who died moving thousands of tons of land to create a crop that made the white plantation owners extremely wealthy. And it was called Unburied, Unmourned, Unmarked. The basis of it is a ritual by some African tribes called Kusup. It's their version of a requiem, as the Latin term refers to it. So it's from a piece that will have four movements called Kusup or Requiem for Rice, but the movement that we performed or debuted in Nashville was Unburied, Unmourned, Unmarked by John Christopher Wineglass. So that was up there with the experience in Ghana, because it is such a powerful piece. And you know, at some point, we'd love to give you some audios of that to share with your audience.
Oh, yeah, I would love that. So all the while, all these other projects are going on, but you had this dream to launch the Color of Music Festival. What is the mission of the Color of Music Festival?
It is very simple. It is to give Black classically trained artists and musicians of African ancestry who are composers and conductors a platform to not only do what they train at the world's top conservatories, but to come together and play music from both the European repertoire and those of Black composers such as Chevalier, de St. George, and many others, to William Grant Still, George Walker, who just passed, and many, many modern composers of today, because their works rarely get played around the world, let alone in the United States, where there's more than 2,000 orchestras, because people just don't know about the repertoire. They don't know the works of Black composers. And unless a young string instrumentalist or wind instrumentalist in college and conservatory has a professor who makes it a point to give the collegians an experience of global music, you know, Latin American music, et cetera, most of them are pushed to the Russians and the Germans and, you know, what we think of as classical music today.
Right.
So that is the mission, is to do that and give those artists who will not get, you know, one of those covenant jobs of those 2,000 orchestras. There's so many people, too many for every position that's around, a chance to do the masterworks, to do Baroque to early classical music. There's so many things that, you know, people of African ancestry, just based on our demographics, don't get a chance to do. And that's why I started the Color Music Festival in 2013.
Wow. And I see that, for example, in 2018, it was in very diverse cities. It was in Washington and Charleston and Pittsburgh and Houston. So I assume the reasoning for that is simply to reach out, again, as you're saying, to sort of make sure this is being represented as far and wide as possible. Are those particular cities just where you got a foot in the door, or was there more of a meaningful, specific connection with those cities in particular?
Well, it's a little bit of both. To give you an example, Houston, you know, connected to the state of Texas, was the second place where Juneteenth for emancipated Africans in this country to be notified that slavery had been abolished, and that Austin, but outside of Austin, I think was the first. But Houston was unique because Houston was the city where I had a connection with someone who was one of the deans at the University of Houston, who made the introduction to the dean of the School of Music. Long story short, we ended up presenting 13 performances in Houston. One of the highlights in Houston was performing a series called The Evolution of Black Music at Emancipation Park. It's a nonprofit called Emancipation Conservancy in downtown Houston on Emancipation Park Avenue, where those folks who were enslaved learn of their freedom. Washington, D.C. was based on a relationship that I had developed many years ago at Duke Ellington School of the Performing Arts in the heart of Georgetown. Mm-hmm. And Pittsburgh is where we birthed the whole idea of the Requiem for Rice Project with Dr. Etta Fields Black at Carnegie Mellon University. And so those cities kind of evolved because of connections, but also because of their interest in Black culture. Pittsburgh, August Wilson, is an icon as one of the most prolific Black writers of his generation. As I said, Houston is connected to Juneteenth. And Washington, D.C., Duke Ellington, what can I say?
It runs
the whole smorgasbord.
Are you expanding to other cities? Do you have any plans for that yet?
Yes. Currently, we're going to expand in Nashville. So in 2020, we'll be announcing what we will be presenting in early 2020 in Nashville. We are actually working on Louisiana. I just won't say where right now because I'll just say this. There's a lot of French influences there. And because Chevalier is our poster person, there's a deep connection to our 240 plus years of being very close to the French Republic. And so there are some ventures out west that I'm cultivating. And even in Ohio. There's some projects we're working on out there. So a lot of these things, we don't, you know, go to print or put anything out there until everything is signed and dotted and so forth. But
Sure. The
wonderful news is what we're doing, giving Black classically trained artists from around the globe this platform, is resonating around, I would say, the globe. There are iterations here in the state, which you're probably familiar with, that have focused on people of color, but it's been a different approach. There's the Detroit-based organization that focuses on adjudication, and now they have a conference. And then there's an organization in Rochester, New York, that is somewhat of a reunion for Eastman School of Music graduates. And then there's Color of Music, whose mission is different than all of those, in that we do everything from vocal, piano, organ, chamber, masterworks, and symposium and literary is a part of our offer.
So, of course, with the understanding that you can't list everybody and you're not playing any favorites here, could you give us a couple of names of some of these musicians some of the people who are really particularly outstanding, people whose names we really should know, whether they're composers or performers or conductors.
Laquita Mitchell, who is a soprano from New York City, you know, really came on the scene 15 years ago, but just became extremely big when she had her debut at San Francisco Opera as Bess. But she sung in Europe, London, you know, all kinds of opera companies around the West Coast, Los Angeles. She's probably the most amazing person that I've dealt with because I met her when she was a sophomore in college at Westminster Choir College. We were both singing the German Requiem during Spoleto Festival USA, and we have remained friends. And now she's one of our leading sopranos who was mentored by Jesse Norman. She was very close to Miss Norman. The other would be Roderick Dixon, who is an amazing tenor, who most people got to know in the early 90s when he was the standout among the three Mo tenors, M-O. Not the three tenors, but the three Mo tenors. He has done some incredible things with us. He's done that lead in The Chariot Jubilee by Nathaniel Dett, as well as Hiawatha's Wedding Feast by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, which is a huge piece by this British composer, Samuel Coleridge Taylor, that really folks look at him as the Black Mahler because of how he composed music. And they were large, large orchestras. But Rod and Laquita would be among the top. And one of my shining stars right now is a Black German violinist by the name of Anyango Yarbo Davenport. She was born in Munich and comes from an extraordinary family. Her mother was a classically trained mezzo-soprano. Her father, who's deceased now, was an Austrian conductor. So she grew up in a household where she was immersed in music, and she is probably one of the best Black violinists out there right now. And I think that she should be on every American stage doing concertos. But one of the things that we're trying to do is give Black artists access to what I call the last water fountain in America. Mm-hmm. And that is getting Black conductors and artistic departments to stop looking to Europe or now Latin America for their inspiration, because we have it here in the United States. And these artists go to Germany and other places of African ancestry just to get the platform, while American conductors here overlook them. And, you know, I'm shaking the cage, so to speak, and saying, we're not going to wait for you to give us permission to get on your stage. We're going to do it ourselves. And, you know, I want people to come on board with us. They can support us by buying tickets, but they can more importantly support us by donating to a very worthy cause for these musicians who literally go to the top conservatories. And they cannot get on concert stages in America. So the next time you go to your symphony, ask your symphony executive director, why are they not putting more Black people on the podium and next to the podium? And watch for the answer.
I have been furiously scribbling the names that you are giving me because although I do know of Roderick Dixon, the other two I was not familiar with. Is there anyone in terms of composers, particularly early composers, for example, besides Chevalier de Saint-Georges, that I should know about as a radio programmer?
Yeah, there was George Amity was someone that very little people know about. He was based out of the Mid-Atlantic area. And there were others who were composing around that time. But, you know, I often say that, you know, when you think about how the continent of Africa became the place where mankind originated, the one differentiating factor that made those contributions from that part of the world less known is it did not have a church infrastructure to permeate its music. Mm-hmm. So think about how the Italian country had the Catholic Church as a means to get their music and their norms musically literally around the globe. So just think about what we would know, knowing that Africa came before Italy, meaning the continent of Africa and where people were living, came before Italy was formed, the little boot rather was formed. what the musical notations would be if that apparatus was in place for the folks who came from the continent of Africa. Just think about it. You know, music notations would, you know, I often say could be in Swahili, they could be in some other language, but that has been the albatross for those who have contributed to the genre, is the music never got this massive audience, okay, to listen to their music.
Well, I can hear you are bubbling over with all these ideas and names and enthusiasm. And I'm curious to know, in addition to the project we've already talked about, including the Color of Music Festival, what other kinds of projects, what other kinds of dreams are percolating in your consciousness right now? Is there anything you can share?
I will tell you this, that there are so many stories for people from my community, Black people, to tell, because we've not been in the executive suite where a lot of decisions of what we see on television and what we see on operas, ballets, and concert halls. But if there was a dream of mine, it would be to give the folks like Angela Bassett, who studied classical theater, a platform that she could not be the extraordinary Black character on the silver screen, but she could actually be that extraordinary character who's speaking in, you know, old English, speaking like Chaucer and Shakespeare, because that's what she's trained to do. But the same thing as Angela Bassett, who's classically trained as a actress, is in the ballet. It is still deeply rooted in the opera house. I mean, a lot of Black female singers, you know, artistic directors look at them for best. I mean, not that I want to lessen the importance of what Gershwin's piece did to give Black artists an opportunity to be on the opera stage. But, you know, Black singers have, they study with the same vocal coaches at these top conservatories and schools. It is still a bias in classical music, and that's why I keep referring to it as the last water fountain for Black people. And until we start going on our own to do our things, we are going to be just sitting back waiting on some liberal-minded white person to say, I want more Black folks on the stage, because qualifications are there. So they can't say it's not because they're qualified. So that's where I would like to have dreams go. See Black, besides Missy Copeland, other young Black classically trained ballerinas getting lead roles and getting this European construct of what a ballerina looks like. You know, African women don't look like, you know, women of other areas where their bodies based on hundreds and thousands of years of how their ancestors, you know, meandered around the globe. We are the sum of where we come from. And so to have this idea of what a ballerina looks like and just not consider other women because of their body shapes when they are capable of doing it is one of those things, again, we have to do it on our own. So if you ask what are dreams that I would like to see down the road, I have some short-term and long-term goals. Just wait and see, and you're going to see some of them materialize in the ways that I just articulated.
Well, Lee Pringle, I cannot thank you enough for making time to speak with me and for sharing your insight on this really important topic. Thank you.
Thank you.